RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time now for our Legal Hub this Wednesday morning. Katie Ashby-Cobbins joins me. And Katie, I can see you. It looks like you're in warmer climes than me. Oh, my God.
Yes, a little bit warmer, but not so much that you would notice.
No.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, listeners.
Hopefully it'll snow while we're doing this again. All right, this is your case we're about to talk about, isn't this your case?
It's not my case, it's my client's case, but it's a case in Australia that I'm assisting my client with, and it's a bit of a interesting one.
Yeah. Where should we pick this up? Maybe a bit of background first, quickly.
Yeah, sure. So a bit of context. I'm sure a few of your listeners might know that we've taken a few actions on both sides of the Tasman. One to stop the rollout for 5 to 12-year-olds in New Zealand, and then also in Australia, and then also one to stop the rollout to babies. And essentially, the argument was pretty simple. No long-term data, risk of COVID in these age cohorts, very low. Really, really straightforward. Basic pharmacovigilance. These things were getting special. These COVID-19 vaccines were getting special approval. If that was the case, you know, they're getting that special approval because they were not trialed and tested like ordinary vaccines. And so as a consequence, we were just saying, look, don't roll them out to those that have a very low risk of COVID when you don't know what the actual risk is of these new gene therapy vaccines. So that was the upshot. In New Zealand, we got to run the case, and we had the likes of Ashley Bloomfield and Ian Town providing evidence that, you know, the risk of myocarditis in children is great and all sorts of other things. So we went through that process. But in Australia, we've been stopped essentially each way. We haven't even been able to get past first base because the courts have been insistent that the applicants don't have the standing to bring the cases. So we've really got to a point where none of the evidence was able to be put on or heard, even though there was very compelling evidence that we even took to the High Court saying, you know, the risk of life, and you're risking life and injury of babies. And the High Court in Australia turned around and said, oh, you know, we don't have, you know, this will just be administrative slowing down for us, so we are not going to have this case in the High Court, we're just going to send it back to the Federal Court. So that was a pretty clear message to us in Australia that the High Court of Australia, the highest court in the land, was not prepared to look at a case which is asking them to consider the health and safety of infants with respect to these products.
I would have thought that was quite a priority, just off the top of my head, with no legal brain at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it was quite an incredible situation. The High Court was essentially suggesting that the work that they would need to do, because they're normally in appellate jurisdiction where the case would already be heard and the evidence already on, it would just be, you know, administratively cumbersome for them. So it was appropriate to go back to the Federal Court, which we'd already been. So that's a bit of a background to the lead-in to the court case that we started a year ago, almost today, where the applicant, Dr. Julian Fidge, who's both a doctor and a pharmacist, who had administered at least over 10,000 of these COVID-19 injections, is taking a court case against Pfizer and Moderna, seeking that an injunction on the basis that their products are genetically modified organisms, and those genetically modified organisms required Pfizer and Moderna to get a license from the gene technology regulator, but they failed to get the necessary license from the gene technology regulator.
Did they ever attempt to get a license?
Yes, Pfizer certainly attempted, well, made inquiries of the gene technology regulator to get a license should they need one. And the gene technology regulator said, no, your products are not genetically modified organisms. Now, we don't know what Pfizer told the gene technology regulator, but while we were working up this case, a scientist by the name of Kevin McKernan in the States, and I think you've got Jess Rose coming on next, which is really important because
looking forward to that.
She's part of being on papers with Kevin McKernan about this this issue. Kevin was doing some research, required some vials of mRNA vaccines to do some testing that he was doing on marijuana plants because he's a cannabis genomics expert. And he was doing these tests and discovered that these products were contaminated with DNA. And DNA has come from the process two manufacturing, which is different to the manufacturing process that was used for the trials and tested versions of the vaccines. And he's like, why is this in here? It shouldn't be in here. It's DNA. Yes, sometimes you have some DNA from E. coli, but this is DNA which is of high levels, and it's not DNA, naked DNA anymore, because we've got the lipid nanoparticle transportation system which these products use to get the mRNA into people's cells. So at the time of doing our case, or working up the case, all of this DNA contamination was found, and the DNA contamination also satisfies the definition of genetically modified organism and Australian law.
Wow. Okay. So that's a double hit on that.
Double whammy, yes.
So the curious case of the federal court judge.
Yes. So we have a piece of legislation. Dr. Fidge says he's an aggrieved person under the Act because he's had to deal with these genetically modified organisms by, you know, having them himself, administering them to thousands of his patients and giving them to his children, not knowing that they were GMOs, and he couldn't tell them, his patients or anybody, that they were genetically modified organisms. And they're genetically modified organisms because they're capable of affecting a person's DNA makeup or their genetics. The federal court heard the case, and the federal court judge found in favour of Pfizer and Moderna, saying that Dr. Fidge was not an aggrieved person because he did not deal with the products. Administering them into the arms of your patients or clients is not dealing with the products. And Justice Rofe, who was the judge that considered the case, said clearly that Dr. Julian Fidge was not aggrieved, but maybe a courier driver might be aggrieved because they would be dealing with the GMOs.
So that's odd. Let's note that that's kind of an odd approach. Yeah.
It's a bizarre decision because, of course, Julian Fidge has to take the vials out of the fridge, you know, suck them up into an injection and administer them and then throw out the vials. So, you know, he's handling the product so much closer than what a courier driver might if they were in a box, presumably in a refrigerated case of some sort, given the transport requirements for these products. So an odd decision. After the case, after we received the decision, and thinking that the decision was particularly odd, it came to our attention that Justice Rofe, the judge that made the decision in favour of Pfizer, had actually been Pfizer's barrister on at least five occasions in the decade of 2000s.
See.
So we have a situation where the judge failed to let us know that she had been Pfizer's barrister for five significant pieces of cases. She also failed to tell us that she was closely related to Australian pharmaceutical dynasty. She'd sat on boards and been closely involved in various different aspects of the pharmaceutical industry, including her cousin, who was a guy called Andrew Grimshaw, who was closely associated with, well, it is the pharma dynasty, but, you know, you've also got payments from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to this organisation. And this is a case they really don't want to see the light of day.
What sort of disclosure of information like that is required of a judge in this case?
In the first instance, Justice Rowe should have recused herself. When she got handed the file and looked at it, she should have said, look, I can't realistically make a decision on this case. Pfizer used to be my clients, and I have also been significantly involved in the pharmaceutical industry. That's what should have happened. Alternatively, she could have come on the first directions hearing in the last quarter of last year saying, I have been to, I have acted for Pfizer before, I'm letting the parties know, should anyone have any concerns, I will recuse myself. But she should have given us all of the facts so that we could have made a decision and asked her to recuse herself. That was the alternative. Instead, she said nothing. She didn't make a mention of it. Now, this is a judge who, in her admission to being a judge, her ceremony, I think Pfizer was mentioned two or three times in her speech. So it's not an insignificant client relationship if it's being mentioned in your speech as you're being admitted to, you know, the role of a judge, the bench. Correct. So that was pretty incredible.
Can I ask you what your reaction to finding that out was? You'd fall off your chair, wouldn't you, a bit?
Absolutely. So the test with this essentially is the pub test. Does it pass the sniff test or does it pass the pub test? Uh-uh. You know, it doesn't. And my feeling when I heard it was immense disappointment at this utmost disrespect that we were being shown by a member of the judiciary that's supposed to be above all of these things. It's supposed to, you know, duty and obligation requires them to let you know that there is a potential conflict, if not an actual conflict. We have to deal with that every day. Every time I get a new client, I need to look at the matter. I need to consider who's involved. I need to consider whether or not there's a possible conflict. Even if there is one that seems to be a conflict and it's not actually a conflict, I'm still duty bound to go and talk to my client about that before I accept their brief. We weren't given that courtesy and it just possibly wasn't extended to us.
Any reason why that would be, though? Because she obviously knew her history and others would have too, I would have thought.
Yes.
Colleagues and friends and associates.
And the Chief Justice of the Federal Court, which we'll come to shortly, which is an important point. Absolutely. So the registrar that had provided her the file, Justice Rowe, the file, perhaps, you know, might not know, but Justice Rowe and certainly her colleagues would know. So massively disappointed and really, I guess, yeah, just I can't say what she was thinking. I really can't. It's just a huge amount of disrespect and it's a failure to follow duty and obligation. And there is significant case law and information about these kinds of situations. She should have recused herself. It should never. There were 17 other judges in Melbourne. It's not as if we were in a backwater town and only had one judge to hear the matter. There were 17 other possible judges that could have received this case.
Money is being spent as well, right?
Huge amounts of money is being spent. You know, we've got Pfizer and Moderna who are making my client jump through every single hoop, but we've also got a situation where we potentially don't have a decision that we can appeal because the judge, Justice Rowe, negated her judicial authority. So we lodged a complaint with the Chief Justice of the Federal Court and said, Chief Justice, we've got a situation. Justice Rowe not only failed to disclose this key pieces of information, she failed to do so in a timely way and before she made this decision. So this decision shouldn't actually exist. She negated her judicial authority. So we raise a complaint with you and we ask you to determine the complaint. Was Justice Rowe's conduct such that the decision should not exist? And there is case law on that. And the Chief Justice, she has declined to engage with us on the complaint. She's kept the complaint on foot She's appointed a handler to assist her with the complaint. In appointing a handler, she's indicated that she has a reasonable belief in the complaint, but she's telling us that we have to go through the appeal process to deal with a case that we're saying, a decision that we're saying is unappealable.
Yeah.
So wow. we're in a pretzel-like shape of, you know, where to, what to from here. And I can only perceive that there is a desire to exhaust my client both emotionally and financially, because none of this is cheap.
Boy, that's going down the rabbit hole here.
It is, but it gets better.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah.
We're ready.
So because the Chief Justice hasn't dealt with the complaint and we can't reasonably go on to appeal, my client's taken a High Court, a constitutional writ in the High Court, seeking that the High Court make a decision, and this is the highest court in the land of Australia, to make the Chief Justice make a decision on the complaint. So we have gone up a court, taken an extraordinary step in filing an application against the Chief Justice, requiring her to do her job, which is to give my client procedural fairness in that he can have a decision that is made reasonably and without a massive conflict.
So what happens next? Because I know we're short of time this time around. What happens next?
That's a very good question. That could probably be an update for next week, because we're right in the middle of it all, and I'm just putting on it various court steps at the moment, and I'll have another update. But at this point in time, we would trust that the High Court is going to make a reasonable decision, much more reasonable than it did in the baby's decision, and actually require the Chief Justice to make a decision on whether or not the original decision should even be in existence.
Why do I always get the feeling in these cases, Katie, that the judiciary, not only here, but where you are, and maybe in other jurisdictions similar, are kind of looking like they're siding with a particular side all the time?
That's right. And look, this is quite incredible. There is supposed to be the separation of powers. You have the judiciary, which is the third branch of government that is there to keep checks and balances on the government. But the decisions to date, the approaches to date, really seem to lack the independent judicial authority to suggest that people are getting a fair deal when they bring very reasonable cases to the courts.
In this particular area, though, you know, in this particular, the COVID thing, the vaccination thing.
That's correct. That's correct. And we talk about it, we've talked about it quite a bit before. You know, there are certain cornerstone pillars of society in which we thought and believed that there were certain legal principles that were inalienable. And a lot of those have been put under threat during the COVID period. And they seem to have been justified.
Yeah.
And it's quite incredible. I've definitely seen a very different side of the law.
Did you ever think you'd be facing down something like this, ever?
Oh, never in a million years. You just wouldn't. You would never think that you would be seeking a Chief Justice to do and make a decision of one of her colleagues for conduct which should never have happened in the first place. And look, we haven't even got on to the point for which we're trying to get onto, which is, if these products are GMOs, how on earth is Pfizer and Moderna able to distribute them without a license? And the problem is we've now had vials tested from Australia. It took us quite a bit of time to find a lab that would test them. They have been independently tested, and we've got some of the highest DNA contamination in the Australian vials, of all of the vials that have been independently tested around the world to date. And one of them includes a pediatric version of the vaccine. So, you know, we are simply trying to avoid a tragedy or further tragedy and travesty. And my client's being shut out every which way he goes.
Liability, where does it end up ultimately? Because I guess that could maybe point in a particular direction of why things are like they are. Is there who gets left holding the liability in that case, particularly in the GMO area?
It's a really tough one. The TGA, who is approved, the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia, that approved these products, that supposedly allowed Pfizer to monitor their own products themselves, or Moderna to monitor their own products themselves. You know, the fact that these products weren't pulled as early as they were when they first had some of the initial safety signals, it's incredible that they're still on the market.
So ultimately the state, right?
Ultimately the state, if it's found that Pfizer and Moderna committed fraud, then that could void their indemnities that the state has offered them under the contract. But I think at the end of the day, it has to come back to the state, which again is us paying for it.
Yeah, in the end. But yeah, you can see why the state might want to, even though it's supposed to be an independent part of it, protect itself or minimize the exposure of the risk.
Oh, this is a very inconvenient situation.
All right. Well, that's really, really interesting. And there'll be more. So we can maybe get updates on the progress of this from you as we go, right? Yep.
Absolutely. So you can check out, there's regular updates on our Give, See, and Go page, which is just useful location. So Give, See, and Go GMO is one thing you could search to find more information on the federal court case. Then we've also got another site that you can have a look at called section72.au. That's section72.au, because there's another element of this case where we're actually asking both houses of parliament to investigate Justice Rowe's conduct under the constitution. So it's multifaceted, and it's an incredible situation to be in.
Quick question to end on, Katie. Is that DNA stuff in the vials of the New Zealand batches?
Yes, one of the vials that was tested from Australia was distributed in New Zealand.
Interesting. Okay. All right, Katie Ashby-Coppins, our legal hub. Everyone's scratching their heads right now, like, whoa.
Now, I do have a promise. I have been looking at the revised pandemic plan, and I do have an update. I do need a bit more time just to get more thoroughly across the documents. You know, I wanted to work through and identify exactly the key changes or differences between the Health Act 1956, which we have had in place since 1956, and the interim New Zealand pandemic plan. So there's something coming on that shortly. I do know people are very interested to know about that, but I just need a little bit more time. It's quite a long document and I want to be very thorough.
Fair enough. No problem at all. You're cleared to do that.
Thanks.
All right. We'll see you in a week, Katie. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.